I'm staring at the eviction notice. I'm frozen, terrified. I'm thinking about Laura, my little daughter, and my baby who'll be born into homelessness. Today, I can tell you straight up, if it wasn't for Threshold and the people who donate to them, me and my girls would be homeless.
Threshold saves 9 families every day from homelessness. Please support our At Home for Christmas appeal. Help us stop homelessness before it happens.
Visit threshold.ie to make an instant Christmas donation.
Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back talking to Gavin Sheridan, who we haven't spoken to in a while. And if you're familiar with Gavin, he's CEO of Viz Legal, which is this incredible piece of software that does a lot of work for the legal people in the legal world who need information and can't put their hands on it. But for purposes of this, he's also a co-founder of Right to Know, and we will be getting into that in a second. But before we go there, Martin, there was a bit of news on the public services card, and I think I put it down myself. How I put it was, RIP public services card. You will live on forever. Can't believe it. I want to run to you. Really can't believe this.
Yes, that mandatory but not compulsory, and I have incredibly strong legal advice, all washed out this morning, and the public services card cannot be used for things other than the Department of Social Welfare. The court case is gone. That's it. Over and done with.
It's over and done with. The state didn't decide really when we got to the steps of the court to use that parlance. They decided not to even engage with it.
That's it.
Yeah, we should.
Right.
So they should have just accepted what they were told, you know.
Absolutely. Should have accepted what they're told. And now everybody has to scramble, including the licensing authority and everybody else has to scramble to come up with a different means of, first of all, the issuing licenses, anything like that, any access to the state. So they should have just listened, Tony, to the experts who told them over and over again.
Yeah, just another example. And Gavin, you might, I don't know if you want to comment on this, but it's again another example of when we go down the road of people like yourselves and Right to Know and people who you work with in that organization pointing out that this didn't even stand up to the old Data Protection Act, never mind GDPR, and now we're here again.
Yeah, obviously the qualifier is I'm not a lawyer, but do I read a lot of very good legal opinions on Twitter from very very eminent people who understand the detail and the nuance of GDPR and the data protection acts that came before GDPR. It was clear from day one that this is what was going to happen. Because if you read any Court of Justice decision that interprets the GDPR or its predecessors, there is no allowance for this to happen. It's just not something you can do. You can't cross-populate data between different things and then use other things for different purposes without adequate ways or adequate remedies. But also in this case, just what they were doing wasn't really allowed. That was just kind of it. And it doesn't matter what the Irish courts as such say, which we'll come back to, I think, in a bit. It doesn't really matter what the Irish courts and how the Irish courts might interpret it. It's how the Court of Justice interprets it, because obviously this stems from a European regulation. And, you know, that's kind of it. And we have to comply with EU law.
And actually, we'll come straight to the courts first, and we'll come straight there first. There is a trip to the Supreme Court coming up next week. Now, I have to say, I would be quite excited to have a case in the Supreme Court, regardless of what it was. Are you excited about it, Gavin?
I'm always excited about court cases. This is my third run at the Supreme Court. So, and it's actually, interestingly enough, it's kind of a similar issue to other cases that Right to Know has taken and I've taken in the past. So yeah, it's always interesting to go to the Supreme Court. It's always fun. I've had these unique, weird experiences of representing myself in a Supreme Court hearing with Susan Denham at the time, trying to get an expedited hearing in the NAMA case that goes back 10 years ago around whether NAMA was a public body or not. And here we are again, asking a similar question of similar bodies to see, can we get clarity on the law?
Will you give us a little brief breakdown of what's going on there, Gavin?
So it's an interesting one for the legal nerds, but I think it's more interesting kind of in the context of the changing public consciousness when it comes to the environment. Because what we've seen, I guess, in the last decade is climate change has now kind of gone from what probably 10 or 15 years ago was fairly a side nerdy issue that was not really at the forefront of public consciousness to being very much at the forefront of public consciousness. So environmental rights and environmental rights litigation, I think, are becoming more and more interesting to the public in general. And Right to Know has been doing environmental related access to information litigation now for several years. Yep. So what we, I suppose, to explain the strategy, first of all, to some degree, is Right to Know, as principle says, as an organization, we say access to information is a fundamental right. And that could be environmental information, or it could just be information in general. We don't tend to focus on what we were just discussing, which is data protection and GDPR. They're rights that are your own rights to access your own information. What Right to Know does is, in general, accessing information from public authorities. So environmental information, records, documents, databases, whatever it is. And we see those as fundamental rights under the Constitution and under European human rights law and under the charters of the European Union. So it's very much a rights-based thing. We see that if you're Joe Public and you want to exercise your rights to access information from a public body about, you know, why was that house down the road sold for €1 or whatever it is that you're interested in, you have a right to ask for that information. And that right stems, we believe, from human rights, i.e. from Article 10 of the Convention, which is your right to freedom of expression. Because the logic is, how can you have a right to freedom of expression if you don't have access to information? It's really that simple. It's like that's the logic of a decision in the European Court of Human Rights called Magyar Helsinki. And they essentially said, you can't have a full right to freedom of expression if you can't access information, right? So the principle Right to Know operates under is that we need to advocate for these rights, and that will involve court cases. Now, the environmental side of things stems, and I'm going to go into the weeds here a bit because it's actually really important how this works. There was a convention signed back in the late 1990s called the Aarhus Convention, named after the town in Denmark. And this convention was like, when you remember when the green movement was taking off during the 90s, it was a big thing and the Greenpeace was all in vogue and stuff like that. At the time, they signed this international treaty called the Aarhus Convention, which essentially established three pillars for any signatory to this convention.
I can hear attractive Ivrin getting annoyed already, but go ahead.
And Attractive is a big fan. I'm a big fan of Attractive as well. You have the access to justice pillar, the access to information pillar, and the public participation in decision-making pillar. And these are all set down in the treaty and in international law that Ireland is a party to. The EU itself signed up to this treaty, as did many of the member states of the EU, and non-EU members are also party to this convention. So one of the pillars is the access to information pillar, which says that there are laws that will be created that allow the public to ask for information, and the public authority are obliged to disseminate environmental information proactively, right? Now, the EU adopted this international treaty, and then it created a directive called the Aarhus Directive, which mandates member states to transpose into national legislation. That's how directives generally work. So we have to transpose this directive into our national law, which creates the legal rights around it, such as asking for environmental information from public authorities. The trick with this law, compared to FOI, which most people will be familiar with, is in FOI, the minister kind of decides what is or is not a public body. The Minister for Finance, or Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, essentially decides what is or is not a public body that has to be amenable to the FOI Act. But it's different with the Aarhus one. With the Aarhus one, a public authority is defined in a certain way based on that treaty, and that's gone into a directive, and then that's gone into our national legislation. And it defines it in a particular way, right? And it's quite broad, but it doesn't say, it doesn't give you a list. It says, this is what a public body probably looks like, right? It doesn't give you, it gives you a wide definition, but it says, if it's this, this, and this, it's a public body. But it's not entirely defined, but it's quite broadly scoped. And this is key to this court case that we're in next week. So when we transposed the EU directive into national law, we did it in a statutory instrument when Dick Roach was the minister back in 2007, called SI 133/2007. That's the law that empowers me as a member of the public to file an AIE request to a public authority, where a public authority is broadly defined, right? So when the NAMA case came up in 2011, or when I initiated the process in 2010, I sent a request to NAMA and to Anglo Irish Bank using this particular law, saying, I think that you're a public authority under this law. I'd like the following information. And they wrote back and said, we're not public bodies. And I said, I think you are. And then it ended up in the Supreme Court 5 years later, where the Supreme Court found that NAMA was a public body under that broad definition that we're talking about. And that was because of a Court of Justice decision that I won't go into, but essentially NAMA was found to be a public body under that broad definition I'm talking about that is in the directive. So then the question that comes from Right to Know over the last 5 years of us taking cases is two things. What is a public body under this law? If there's any doubt, we should probably make it clear what is or is not a public body under this law. And then the second piece of it is, what is environmental information? Because environmental information is a second part of the law, which says environmental information looks like and talks like and quacks like these things, right? And the disputes that Right to Know always has or always has had with Irish public bodies has been a public body writes back and says, we're not a public body, so we don't have to answer your request. And the second one is, well, we are a public body, but that's not environmental information you're looking for. And we're saying it is environmental information that we're talking about. And it's those two disputes, those two tricky things. Are they a public body? And is that environmental information? Are almost all of the litigation Right to Know has undertaken on the environmental side of things. And in this case that we're in the Supreme Court next week for 2 days, that's one of the key issues. So to give you the very, and sorry, it's such a long-winded question.
I think people need to understand this because, you know, when we think about this of what it means, we keep seeing ministers or junior ministers will go on the national airwaves and they'll make comments about people like your organization, like your group. They may not name you, but they'll say these things that are, and then patently are disproven when it gets to the courts. They lose, you know, and time and time again, they're given a platform to say these things, Gavin, and undermine it, and yet they lose, and there's never any really consequence of that. So I think it's good that you're outlining this.
It's important from a citizen's perspective and from an environmental NGO perspective that we make the best law possible. And what by law, I mean, not just how we transpose directives and how we implement our House Convention related work. Is that the courts make good decisions that reinforce the rights of citizens and NGOs to exercise their rights under these laws, right? So that's what Right to Know engages in, is that we need to take good cases that we win in the courts, that expand what the public authority definition is in the long run, because we think most bodies should be public bodies under this law, and that the definition of environmental information is as expansive as possible, because the environment needs to be protected. And the whole reason this convention came about, the whole reason this whole thing happened, was that they sat down in Denmark in 1998 and said, the environment does not have a voice. So we need to empower citizens and NGOs to give the environment a voice, right? That's why the law exists. That's the whole purpose of this law, right? So we think, how do we take cases that will expand and enforce rights here that environment NGOs and citizens will ultimately benefit from, because an expanded scope of public authority definition and an expanded understanding of environmental information are good things for the public, for Joe Citizen, for NGOs that want to take cases, right?
And it's educating the courts too, Gavin. We had a chat with a mutual some time back who was talking about all these cases that go through the Irish courts, that it makes the Irish courts have a different level of knowledge about these issues.
It does. And we think that, and also it educates the courts sometimes about the intersection between EU law and Irish law, which I'll mention in a second. But to go to this case in particular, as an example of many, we've had multiple court judgments this year, Right to Know in the High Court, and now now we've got the Supreme Court hearing. But the background to this case is that we filed, or Ken Fox, myself, who Ken Fox would be, have been on before, we filed a request to the Council of State and the office, the OSGP, the Office of the Secretary to the President. And we filed requests for certain environmental information to these two bodies. And these two bodies wrote back and said, we're not public bodies under that particular directive, under that law. And we were like, well, we think you are, which is where these disputes start. So we filed requests for certain climate change related stuff to do with the president. And again, this is not necessarily about Michael D. Higgins. Mm. This is the office of the president. This is the Council of State, regardless of who's on the Council of State. This is more the bodies themselves. Are they subject to this law or are they not? So what's important in here is that, again, this is very similar to the NAMA case. It's about, they say they're not a public authority. We say that they are, you end up in court, right? So the commissioner, when we went to the first stage appeal, the commissioner said they're not public bodies, essentially. Now, something interesting happened when, in the sequence of this event, that you'll be kind of puzzled at, right? And this is a really important point about this court case. When we filed a request, I think it was in late 2017, early 2018, we filed a request. A few months after we filed the request, the minister amended the legislation in question, right? So we filed a request for information from the Office of the President and the Council of State, effectively. And in the summer of 2018, July the 27th, when everybody is on holidays, when the Parliament is out, when the minister might be on holidays, they amended the legislation and explicitly included the Office of the President, the Council of State, as excluded bodies. So it was a direct reaction, as far as we can see, to our request. They amended the legislation subsequent to the request.
Even if we were to even the least cynical person in the world would have to question the timing and the framing of that. Absolutely. And again, I like that you point out it's not about Michael D. Higgins, but it is about ultimately our right to know what public bodies, because they, whatever way they want to dress this up, they are public bodies. These people are appointed as well, and the Council of State, that, you know, there's always great excitement for who's been appointed onto the Council of State, what it does. And I think it's only right that we ask these questions, Gavin. But what I would say to you, though, is given the NAMA experience, and obviously you won that case, this now is looking like you're going to go into this one again, except for, you know, it was easier to kind of shake a stick at NAMA because no one was fond of NAMA. It's a
different kettle of fish now. But what's happening is from a legal point of view, I think it's fascinating, right? So effectively the commissioner found against us, and we said we think the commissioner is wrong. The case ended up in the High Court in front of Judge Barr earlier this year. And we had the hearing remotely on PEXIP. And we had the hearing. The state lawyered up. We lawyered up. The commissioner lawyered up. And we're all in the High Court, right, on a remote hearing. Now, the interesting question here is, and this is something that the courts in Ireland have never really dealt with before in the history of the state. So this has never come up as a concept. The Constitution of Ireland that we adopted back in whatever, 1937, the Constitution says that the President is not amenable to the courts under whatever article, I forget the Article 13, I think. But essentially, the separation of powers in the Constitution says that you can't take the President to court as such. There's a separation. I'm not a lawyer again. I'm paraphrasing. Essentially, the Constitution creates a separation, right? And then the question that arises is, can you litigate even in this case? And that was a thing that came up in the submissions. Can this case even be litigated because of the nature of the Office of the President? So eventually it was decided, yeah, we can. And the state lawyered up. And effectively, the High Court hearing and the High Court decision was one of the first times, I think there was only one previous case in which this came up in 1960s or 1970s, around the separation of powers and the Office of the President. But our question is, and this is the question going to the Supreme Court, is does it matter what the Constitution says? Because if there's a conflict between national law and EU law, EU law comes first. And essentially, that's what a previous Right to Know case found in Right to Know versus the Taoiseach in 2018, where we got Judge Farhaty, where there was a similar dispute over the Constitution says one thing, but EU law says another. It says, well, EU law trumps national law when there's a conflict. That's been the case since we joined the EU in 1973.
So we had that pointed out this week again with the European Commission investigating Ireland on what's happening around the access to data, medical data specifically for the survivors of mother and baby homes, and you know the state trying to come up with a 1989.
And as Simon has eloquently put it on Twitter, you can't have a national law that usurps your fundamental rights. It's not you have to ignore that law. That's you actually have to actively ignore that law if it trumps
Gav, that's not true. First of all, you can write to the Minister for Justice and ask them to give you a dig out. Then you can write to the Minister for Children. And you could just send out and say, please, someone give me an out. We're laughing about this, folks, but it's really serious.
It's really serious. These are your fundamental rights that the state ostensibly, for all we can see, is trying to ignore. You're like, no, some of these rights stem from our membership of the European Union. But anyway, with this Supreme Court case, there's several issues. One is, one issue for Right to Know is, why did the minister amend that legislation in the way that he did? This is not necessarily going to be canvassed in the hearing, but it's a question that we have. Why amend the regulations after we'd filed our request? But then that came up in the hearing in the context of, does those requests made before the SI was amended by the minister, are they valid or are they different from SIs that are requests that are made after the SI was amended? That came up in the hearing. But in this context, the Supreme Court is going to have to deal with a couple of issues. One is, to some extent, what does the Constitution allow? If the OSGP and the Council of State are public bodies, as we argue, then it could end up in a situation where the OSGP ends up as a defendant in the courts. And we're saying, well, we think that that's not necessarily offensive to the Constitution, because they are a public body that holds environmental information that the public has a right to access, right? If the Council of State is discussing, now, there are carve-outs, like in FOI, in AIE, you know, if the body at the time is acting in a judicial or legislative capacity at the time, then it can be excluded from release, right? Or if it's commercially sensitive and other things that can flow just like normal exemptions would apply, which are the safeguards that any access to information legislation has. In this case, though, we're saying the OSGP and the Council of State are clearly public bodies. Barr, in his judgment earlier this year, agreed with us on some of our points and disagreed with some of the others. The state disagreed with his judgment entirely and so sought a leapfrog appeal, which is when you jump from the High Court to the Supreme Court instead of going to the Court of Appeal, if it's a significant public interest issue. And then there was an application made to the Supreme Court for a determination, and then the Supreme Court found, yes, this is a substantial public interest case about the intersection of EU and national law and the Constitution and whether the public has a right to access information and whether these are public bodies. So now we're all going to the Supreme Court on Tuesday for 2 days to see who's right. And the Supreme Court is going to have to decide. And again, this issue around, as you said, Tony, the issue around the intersection of EU and national law is so bloody important. Because in the last case that we, in the first case we won, the Faherty case, our argument was that if there's a cabinet meeting and all the cabinets sit down and have a chat, right? In the Constitution, it says that what's said at cabinet meetings is confidential under the Constitution, right? Yeah. As and we all know about leaks from the cabinet and all that kind of jazz. But in the Constitution, that's what it says. But we argued in the Right to Know versus Antisha case, we said, well, we asked for documents related to the cabinet meeting about what was said at cabinet, which essentially is offensive to the Constitution in some sense, because then we would be going around the Constitution. But what did Faherty decide? She says, well, yeah, but the directive says if it relates to emissions into the environment, particularly, this information is in principle releasable. So it goes around the Constitution because why? EU law trumps national law when there's a conflict, which was what she found. And not only that, she actually made a significant decision inside that decision where she said access to environmental information is a fundamental right. She says explicitly in the judgment, right? So we're dealing with not kind of theoretical rights and administrative rights. We're dealing with fundamental rights under European and Irish law. And we say the Office of the President and the Council of State are public authorities that should be amenable to requests from members of the public about these things. And that's what the hearing is going to be about.
And this is 2 days starting on Tuesday, Gavin?
2 days starting on Tuesday morning, yeah.
Tuesday morning, and you'll be keeping us up to speed, I presume, on the old
I'll seek permission from the court to live tweet the...
Good. Looking forward to that, and absolutely looking forward.
Gav, I want to move us on. You have been talking a lot online. You've covered so much. You have put together a thread that I think within a few hours you had like thousands of people coming to you for the information that you were just filtering on the new variant, the Omicron variant. You've got a weekly Substack. I'm going to say weekly, maybe not always on time, but it's thereabouts. But you've been quite engaged with that. And I mean, people, if they know your background, you know, you've come from a journalist background. You're one of the, I think you were just the second blog ever published, you know,
there was a kind of a dirty dozen of early bloggers back in 2001, 2002. I was one in July, 2002, started the blogging.
Yeah. I remember you used to have to get they'd send around, you'd have to copy the tapes and pass them around. you've been, how do I say this, animated, I believe was the word we used before we came on air, Martin, about the situation in terms of what was being said around the science on how it's evolved around our knowledge of COVID and how we deal with it, and yet the mitigation strategies didn't evolve. Do you want to just give us a little bit of kind of some of your overview of what you looked at? And I mean that as someone who reads the stuff that you put out with great interest, and I think, and I'd recommend it to others.
Yeah, so I suppose with my Substack or my newsletter that I put out almost every week on time, is I read a lot about COVID and climate change and lots of other science related issues. And I've been reading this kind of science related stuff and academic papers around this area my whole journalism career. So I've been reading this a lot of this stuff since the late 90s. And I know Arda Hegarty's been on the show in the past talking about this issue as well around aerosolized virus. And she's been really good on it on Twitter as well. And a bit like myself, kind of banging her head against a wall, I think, for more than a year talking about this issue. But to give you the kind of broader context, right? When the pandemic started, we were figuring out on the fly as a world, right? Not just Ireland, everybody was like, well, there's a new novel virus. We're not quite sure yet how it spreads, but we think it spreads this way. So therefore, we're going to suggest the following measures, mitigation measures, to slow its spread. Now, obviously, the most one that most people are familiar with when it comes to mitigating spread is lockdowns. And the reason lockdowns work, and they do work, is it stops people socializing. That's the whole thinking. It's a very crude measure, but it works because the virus spreads by finding new hosts. And if you stop hosts meeting each other, the virus is obviously going to slow down its spread. So lockdowns is one approach that if you're watching a virus kind of spread exponentially in a population, then obviously if you stop people or prevent people from meeting in a bar or a restaurant or in each other's homes, then the virus has nowhere to go. So it stops spreading. That's the standard logic of lockdown thinking. But then the other measures that were suggested back in February, March last year were things like hand washing. Everybody remembers watching Claire Byrne and have, you know, wash your hands and sing happy birthday. Then there was other measures like 2 meter distance. So if you're far away from somebody, you're less likely to get it and so on. And that's kind of, and then along with masking, that was kind of where the measures stopped in March 2020, when the pandemic was starting. Now that thinking, those measures, were all based on an understanding at the time of how viruses spread, such as this one. So coronaviruses spread in a certain way. And if you think about it very kind of intuitively and logically, you can see why they came up with these measures. So if we believe at the time that the virus can spread through surfaces, so i.e. it's called fomite transmission, i.e. somebody has the virus is on their hands and their hands are dirty, they touch the surface, I then touch that surface because the virus has lived on that surface. Then I touch my eyes or something happens and then I have caught COVID, right? That's fomite transmission. That's why people wash their hands. That's why you have hand sanitizers. That's why people clean surfaces with these chemicals to try and kill any surface virus that might be inside droplets or whatever. What we've learned, just to start with that one, what we've learned since the start of the pandemic and actually quite a while ago, is that it's very, 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 very extremely, if not never, that the virus spreads through that mechanism.
Yeah.
This has been clear since last summer 2020, this has been clear. The science since then has completely reinforced this in studies around the world that we almost have no evidence that this ever happens, that actually when you touch surfaces that you actually can catch the virus through that mechanism, which means that it's not that you're saying people should stop washing their hands or that people should stop cleaning surfaces, is that it's probably not that important, or it's not as important as we thought it was at the start. So therefore, in the hierarchy of measures you should take, it's not the highest. It's probably down at the bottom.
Like we had touching face for a good while until we all realized
it's stop impossible. Stop rubbing eyeballs with eyeballs.
And even things like, remember at the start of the pandemic, you had things like, oh, don't touch your face mask because there might be virus particles on it and then you might get it. So basically, if you look at the science now, or even a year ago, to be honest, this is not new. The virus does not spread this way in general. And we have probably now trillions of transmission events since the start of the pandemic. We almost have no evidence that the virus spreads this way. So that's number one. The second one is the 2 meter distance rule, right? Or 1.5 meters, depending on the country. This was based on the idea that when you talk or cough or sneeze and so on, that the virus is inside the particles that are leaving your respiratory system, and that's how the virus spreads. And that's true. It does spread that way. But the 2 meter distance rule is predicated on an understanding of aerosol transmission that is out of date. What happened at the start of the pandemic was scientists, good public health doctors all believed that the main mode of transmission was heavier particles heavy aerosols that come from your mouth and nose would fall to the ground within that 2 meter distance. Mm. And therefore that 2 meter distance was kind of something that you shouldn't, or that you should mitigate against by having social distance, right? So if you're more than 2 meters away, you should be pretty safe, right? If the viruses fall to the ground when you're talking or breathing or whatever it is, because those droplets are of a certain size that they're heavy enough that they'll fall.
Right? Yeah.
Unfortunately, that science has also been proven to be largely incorrect. The distinction goes back to 1955, and there's a really good article in Wired magazine that I've been sharing on Twitter that drew the distinction between a droplet, i.e. a heavier aerosol that comes from your mouth, at 5 microns, right? And then everything that's less than 5 microns is an aerosol virus or an aerosolized particle that probably doesn't contain virus. Essentially, that was the thinking, that it has to be 5 microns or heavier to have a viable virus essentially in it, is the way I've read the science. This distinction doesn't make any sense. This is what Orla Hegarty has been tweeting about. This is what I've been tweeting about for over a year, back to last summer, June, July 2020.
Martin even had the foresight to get John Wenger on as early as I think it was that time, that period, because if I recall correctly, it was Martin. It was during the summer holidays, and we were talking about how you could open schools safely if you looked into ventilation.
Yeah,
and that was exactly it. Yeah,
this is it. So this distinction is false, and actually the science around that distinction has basically been debunked. All you have, and if you again think about this from first principles, just common sense, when you're talking or singing or shouting, you're generating aerosols that come out of your respiratory system. We now know that the virus can live inside smaller aerosols, not ones that float in the air, not ones that fall to the ground. So what does that mean? It means that the virus is airborne, right? Apparently, this is not understood or accepted by our public health leaders. In December 2021, this is so fucking clear, so excuse my French, this is so clear for so long that so much good science has been done in this area, particularly in the last 12 months. The virus spreads in the air, particularly in enclosed, poorly ventilated spaces. And there was a really good paper, and one of the top people who's been on this since the very beginning is Zeynep Tufekci, who writes for the New York Times. She's a really good sociologist. She's been pointing this out. She wrote a really good piece in The Atlantic last July 2020, about aerosol transmission and about the misunderstanding that's happening in public health between this droplet aerosol distinction, which is artificial, right? We now know, and many, many, many studies have shown, that the virus in a majority of cases spreads in poorly ventilated indoor spaces from people breathing, not necessarily coughing, not necessarily sneezing, not necessarily singing, not necessarily shouting, breathing. Because the virus can fit into the smaller aerosols that just spread in and hang in the air, right? But what I've been trying to say since last year on several Twitter threads is, if we now know that's the case, then your mitigation strategy changes. No longer is 2 meter distance that big a deal. Why? Because it spreads in the air. 2 meters won't save you.
It means nothing. If I'm on the table across... If me and you are out and we decide to even sit at separate tables and text one another, we're not doing anything if it's airborne.
If you walk into a pub, and again, this is an indoor spread virus. If you're out in the fresh air, it generally is going to be harder for you to catch it. Why? Because the air is circulating and you have a certain amount of virus particles that exist within the aerosols in the air if someone is shedding virus, right? But if you're outside, it's not that big a deal. You should probably still wear a mask if you're like in the Aviva, but that's only a mitigation strategy, right? These are risk management things. These are not like, you know, there's no silver bullet here. You do a coordination
I spoke to Marie Casey, who is a specialist in public health, and she was like, her frustration is going, like you've just said, there's no silver bullet. So why aren't we trying these things? Why aren't we trialing these things?
Let me quote Philip Nolan, who was in an Oireachtas committee.
This is going to make our blood boil if you quote this. Just be careful.
So Philip Nolan was at an Oireachtas committee, and Orla Hegarty was also at this Oireachtas committee, as were other members of public health. Tony Holland was at the same committee, right? And in this, he says, and this to me, this is where we're going wrong with all of our strategies right now, right? So he says, it is really important to state that even though people may say they think aerosol transmission is more important than other modes of transition, and therefore ventilation is as or more important, we simply do not have the evidence to back that up. That's not true. We do have evidence to say that aerosol transmission is a predominant way of spreading. Secondly, we know that the virus is transmitted by some mix of direct contact, short-range droplet, and aerosol transmission, where we are close to each other and literally spraying those droplets at each other, and long-range aerosol transmission and surfaces. And then he says, even though we know surfaces probably do not matter much, which is true, but can somebody please tell everybody who keeps cleaning tables all the bloody time? Because it actually is not a big method of transmission. We simply don't know the balance between the others, he says. We do know, in general, the balance between the others. It is generally an airborne virus that transmits in aerosol format, not necessarily through heavier droplets, because the distinction, the science that was based on, was wrong. And it's been proven to be wrong since the start of the pandemic. And then he says, our public health doctors tell us it is usually close contact. Now, if you think about that sentence for a second, our public health doctors tell us it is usually close contact. When you use the word usually, mm-hmm. you're talking about more often than not, right? Which means if you were to split this up into 1 to 100, 100%, right? That means that they think that close contact transmission is the usual method, because he says contact or fomite transmission is not really something to worry about. But then he's also saying it's usually close contact, but that means more often than not. But that means he's also dismissing aerosol transmission, which is actually the other way around.
I need to push in here, because we've seen the language of government change slightly in the last 12 hours, where you had Micheál Martin beginning to distance himself from that language of, you know, we are told the information we receive, and he's pushing back now, saying that, you know, well, and if I'm going to go strip it back, what it actually says is, when there's a public inquiry into this, we're going to say that.
Well, yeah, I did a thread in January about the future of public inquiry into this. And in the thread, I say, this is what the focus of the public inquiry is going to be, is that how wrong have ENFET and the public health doctors he's talking about got it? I would say significantly wrong. Now, if you just look at his last sentence, it is very important, he says, that in the public health messaging, we get the balance right. He's right there. We should get the balance right. And then he says, he starts with hand and respiratory hygiene, physical distancing, mask wearing, and ventilation remain important, but there is no way of knowing which of these is more important. That's not true. We can infer which one is more important. But if you think about the order in which he even said those, he started with hand and respiratory hygiene, then physical distancing, then mask wearing, and then ventilation. And if that's if you're thinking that that's the way you're going to say it, you're going to say it in that hierarchy, right? But the hierarchy is assways. It's the other way around. You start with air quality. You start with how good and healthy is the air. That's ventilation and filtration. Then you go masks, because that's how the virus gets out of your lungs, right? And into your lungs is through your nose and your mouth, right? It doesn't get into your hands. It doesn't get into your eyes. It gets into your nose and mouth. It's an airborne virus, and it's a respiratory disease, right? And that's it. How we have not finally decided that this is actually how the virus spreads. And remember, from a political standpoint, when Micheál Martin or Leo Varadkar or whoever says, our public health advice is the following, therefore we're going to carry out the following mitigation strategies. If the public health advice is itself incorrect, the mitigation strategies are wrong by logic. You know?
Isn't the proof positive of this, and the proof positive of this arse about face, is the schools?
The schools, to me, is fascinating, right? Schools, by their nature, are enclosed indoor spaces containing human beings who have respiratory systems. I know this is a shock to everybody, but children have lungs and mouths and noses, right? They can get infected. They can spread the virus to each other. Where? In enclosed indoor spaces where there's 30, 40 children to a class, where there's a teacher who are spreading the virus. Like, I was only looking at the numbers last night.
Yeah.
In the last two-week period, 14,000 children caught positive COVID tests in the two-week period that is most recently available. 14,000. In September, it was 5. Now, apparently the public health advice that Philip Nolan has tweeted this back in September, where he said the virus is not spreading in schools, effectively is what he said. If you just intuit that statement, of course the virus spreads in schools. It's like saying children don't breathe on each other. Of course they breathe on each other.
And yes,
ventilation can help mitigate the spread, but you should be doing everything to help mitigate spreads. That includes children wearing masks. Why? Yeah. Because they have lungs and they have mouths and they have noses.
But Gavin, we have to talk about filters, this as a psychosocial experiment, and we're going to do, and it's, oh my God, as a parent of two children, I can tell you they have no problem putting on their masks.
Wearing masks is just wearing masks. Why? Children don't see a true political or, freedom lens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? It's just mask wearing. It's not the end of the world. Children will accept. It's like, okay, I'll wear it. And again, it's not to say that you can pick holes in this and say, oh, well, children might take their masks off, or they might. Yeah. Of course. But when you're managing risk, it's all about mitigation overall. On balance, when you mix these measures together, will we be able to reduce spread? So good ventilation, better masks. Like this blows my mind, right?
Yeah.
We're still talking about the medical grade, the blue masks they have on the outside, and cloth masks. At the start of the pandemic, they were good enough because there was shortages of all the other types of masks that are higher quality. The problem is, and again, this comes down to incorrect public health advice that is coming from our public health leaders. I still don't understand why we're so long into the pandemic and this is happening. I tweeted this back in January. I said, the first thing the state should do is send N95 or FFP2 grade masks to every household in the country. Doesn't matter the cost, just do it, right? Why? Because you start the training and telling people how the virus spreads. Why are these higher grade masks so important? Because the aerosols are smaller.
I want to move on again and say just the same logic when it came to when they spoke about antigen tests, a snake oil. Now, again, it's just another, if we're going to use that awful phrase, like it's another bullet in the gun to try and reduce the risk. That's all we were talking about. But it was called snake oil and dismissed out of hand. And, well, and then we were told, look, it's their 25 quid for four. Oh, they'll come down. And the invisible hand of the market made them more affordable. I know people in London, UK now who they collect them from the pharmacy in packs of four and they test themselves regularly. Okay, that's what they do. Whatever way you want to think about how these things can be done, all of these things are within our reach. And this is in the same breath. The government announced, I think this morning, they're going to spend 200 million, giving everybody 100 quid off their electricity bill.
Right, so there's all sorts of interesting concepts in here about groupthink, about not accepting new evidence, about not understanding that we can learn as we go. And I said at the very start of the pandemic, I said, the lesson for us is, do we learn from our mistakes or not? And do we continue to evolve our understanding of the pandemic and adapt based on those, right? Even if you just take Omicron, you had the outbreak in Norway the other day. You had a wedding party, or sorry, a Christmas party, where a load of people got Omicron, probably the whole room. All those people left the room. And then more people came in and they got Omicron.
Yeah.
There was no close contacts that we're aware of. In other words, the virus was still in the room, right?
That's right. Hanging
in the air, as we know it does. Every study that you look at, even the ferret study that was done, two ferrets separated by in boxes, where one had COVID and one didn't. And the only mechanism of transmission that could have happened was extremely light aerosols, i.e. the really, really small particles that hang in the air, and the other ferret or whatever got infected. So when you're looking at this from first principles, it's as simple as this. The virus spreads in the majority of cases in indoor environments that are poorly ventilated because the virus is in little tiny particles that are really small that previously scientists would have thought were too small to spread the virus. But now we know better. That 5 microns and less allows the virus to spread.
But isn't it? It is actually politics that's screwing this up, Gavin. It is politics that's screwing it up.
So people keep saying this to me on Twitter when I talk about this, where they say, well, the underlying rationale for not wanting HEPA filters is the government doesn't want to spend the money on infrastructure and they want to focus on personal responsibility to stop the spread of the virus. I don't necessarily agree with that argument. What I actually think is happening is, and Tony kind of mentioned this earlier, is that they push back and say, well, the public health advice is that, so What are we going to do? Like, Micheál Martin's not a public health expert, and I wouldn't expect him to be, right? He's the leader of Fianna Fáil. He's a Taoiseach. I would expect that the public health advice would be good public health advice. I would expect that NPHET would inform the government what the facts are.
But when the facts change, I change my fact provider.
Well, this is the issue that came up with Stephen Donnelly when he mentioned AMREC as one of the sub-teams in the HSE public, the public health emergency team. And the AMREC essentially said, we don't need filters because they probably don't work. And then the ventilation, John Wenger's team said, well, we absolutely do need filters. And then Stephen Donnelly said, well, AMREC says this, so what am I going to do? I do think there might be an element of infrastructure cost to this, right? But overall, the buck to me still stops with NPHET. If NPHET are giving bad advice, NPHET are giving bad advice. And that bad advice needs to stop, right? We need to adapt to the new understanding of viral transmission and then adapt our strategies to do that. And even just, Tony, to mention briefly, air filters and air purifiers in schools is not just, the benefits are not just, we've got less virus in the air, because you could have 3 or 4 air changes per hour, depending on the filter. You can build your own filters, by the way. It's like 80 quid to build your own filter. Anyway, you could put your filters in schools, right? And you're doing number of air changes per hour. That's cleaning the air all day, every day. And that means that, you know, there's less virus particles in the air. That's science, right? But on top of that, what are the other benefits of air purifiers and good ventilation in schools? A lot of studies have shown less problems with asthma, because asthma can be triggered by air particles coming from cars and fumes from emissions and so on. You have more oxygen in the classroom. What does the brain need in order to learn? Oxygen, right? If there's too much carbon dioxide in a room, children start falling asleep. You remember falling asleep in classes where the windows were closed and you're like, you can't concentrate, right?
For about all 6 years.
Think about all of the benefits that would come, not just viral transmission.
Again, I can't help in that note. And I think I'm right in saying there's an estimate that the average, on average, 1,300 people die a year in Ireland because of situations with effectively breathing bad air. So
the investment is not me. I don't, to be honest, at this stage of the pandemic, we spent 42 billion euros so far between the PUP and between all the measures that have been taken since the start of the pandemic. And we're talking about, I think, to be honest, he's overestimating it. I think the Corey Rosenthal boxes that they were building in the US last year, which is the name for the handmade boxes that you can build using 4 HEPA filters and a fan and just seal it. You can build those for £80. Like, it's not, the problem to me is not necessarily the cost. It's not the political will per se, although it might play a part of it. It's that for an order for all these things to happen, we have to accept the science of how the virus itself is spreading.
I accept all of that, but I would push back and support Martin's point that there is also an issue that within government, we have 3 parties and they're not all pulling in the same direction.
That's true, but I still think no matter who was in government, if Sinn Féin was in government and the public health advice was not viral transmission, we'd be in the same boat.
I'm not a great supporter of what the opposition have done throughout this. I'm simply not, actually.
Except Paul Murphy.
I was about to say, Paul Murphy, God bless him, because we give him an awful time, but Paul has been very good.
He's 100% correct.
Yeah. And has been proven right time and time again. But again, if I go back to it, you know, I can tell you straight off, there was Leo Varadkar was in Saudi Arabia, which also I think was an outrage and didn't get enough coverage. What happened there? But he told people in the IDA, I don't support restrictions. I don't support. And he spoke about, in effect, he's been calling for weeks now, natural immunity. He's moved into that category of the, you know, the Sweden let it rip thing.
There will be no natural immunity. That's it. This virus is with us for a long, long time, as far as I can see. And it was 3 really good pieces that I'll be putting in the newsletter that were in the Atlantic in the last few days that discussed this issue. You know, Omicron is the next variant. There's going to be more. We might have to generate mRNA vaccines for each significant new variant if they don't give us full protection. But already Omicron is showing signs that it can spread. And again, one of the factors here is people say, oh, it only gives you mild illness. It doesn't really matter if it gives you mild illness. If it's 2 to 3 times more transmissible than Delta, you're still going to get a lot of people getting sick, and you're still going to see hospitals getting a lot of people arriving at them in the next 3 weeks. Because if you have exponential spread in the UK, it's doubling every 2 to 3 days. you can extrapolate unless certain measures are taken. Again, it's about measures versus risk, and about how you try to reduce future potential hospital load, is all understanding the lags between someone getting affected, being symptomatic, shedding the virus, then getting sick, then staying in bed, then getting too sick that they have to turn up to a hospital, then they go into a hospital, then they might go into ICU. So you have all this lagging information about how viruses spread. And yet we still seem to be making the same mistakes we did back in March and April 2020. And the fundamental thing here for me is how the virus spreads is such a basic question.
Yeah.
We now know to a very confident degree that the virus spreads in a certain way that our public health leaders don't appear to accept, or else they accept that the balance is that it's probably, you know, 60% close contact / fomite transmission and 40% aerosol. Whereas I'm saying, and the science really is strongly saying, it's more like 80% or 90% aerosol and 10%, 20% close contact, i.e. the heavier bits are more likely to fall on you. Of course they are, but they're still all aerosols.
I'm going to leave the last word on this to one of our mutuals, to Simon, who said when the Taoiseach put up that it could cost up to 90 million for HEPA filters. And Simon said, what's the cost of not doing it?
Well, this is it. The cost of not doing it is we're going to have a lot of infected children. And we don't know the long-term consequence of children getting infected. There's children in hospital right now with COVID.
And those numbers are sadly much higher per head of capita than because we were told we had, when this pandemic started, that we'd kind of, well, isn't it lucky that it doesn't actually impact children? It's predominantly an old, and that's
exactly, and we've moved on from that thinking as well over the past 12 months.
And
Tony, even if you look at the last data we have for Ireland, you have 21% of all detected cases in Ireland in the last data were children between the ages of 5 and 12, right? But what's also happening is if you take that 21%. And you add in 0 to 4 year olds, it's 25% of all cases detected in the last 2 weeks were children. But that's only detected cases. When you're looking at a virus like this, you extrapolate the number of detected cases again by up to a factor of 7 for the number of actual cases in the community, right? Depending on where we're at in the pandemic. So you can have tens of thousands of children currently infected with COVID. We don't know the long-term consequences, and the mitigation strategy we're using don't seem to be the correct ones because the science that they're using is dated.
Gavin, we have taken so much of your time this morning, and we do know you're quite busy. I mean, you're going into the Supreme Court on Tuesday. I'd be rattling. I'd be taking the coffee down. I'd be chain smoking, but I'd also enjoy it. So we do sincerely hope that it goes well for you in the Supreme Court, and we sincerely hope that you enjoy it.
I have an awesome legal team to help me. That's so Fred Logue, who's been on the show before.
Oh, look, Fred's a friend at a pub. What I will say is, if you're a solicitor, listen to this. Check out Gavin's services; it's fantastic. If you're interested in this sort of stuff, check out Gav's Substack; it's really, really good. And the guy stays busy, so if he hasn't hooked you in with all of that information yet,
and one thing I will say, Tony, to plug the business, which is my full time job.
Yeah,
we recently rolled out a feature now where we've automated the Circuit Court diary for every firm in Ireland, so we know where every firm in Ireland is supposed to be in the Circuit Court all over the country every day. And they might not.
That's a big wow, because I know how difficult that is. That is really a big difficult. Wow.
Yeah, no, because Martin, you're generally running from court to court.
It's the only time I put on a suit.
Listen, folks, we are back later on this afternoon with Blani Mfako from Massey, obviously. So that's a conversation with Rory. I'm looking forward to hearing. We do appreciate it. You heard at the beginning of this pod, we're running the ads for Threshold and Focus Ireland. We could really do with the support, but you know what? It's the spirit of goodwill. So, you know, maybe consider helping those who are less fortunate. And we will be back on Sunday. We're trying to put together a less heavy show, Martin. Am I right here?
Yeah. Well, I'd like to catch up with a few people. Like, can I say who's one person who's coming?
No, you can't.
I'm not allowed. He won't even let me.
No. We will talk to you all very soon, folks. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin. Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.